I'll be giving demonstrations of timbres that move me.
The opening effect here is achieved by tapping the strings with the back of a spoon.
As well as playing recordings that make me adore my instrument. Mainly music that's been composed for the classical guitar, though also featuring music for its relatives.
Here the oud meets American bluegrass.
The aims are simple: to move you, entertain you, and hopefully even provoke you. Join me for Sean Shebe's Guitar Zillion on BBC Radio 3 on Sunday evenings at 11 and available now on BBC Sounds.
Next this afternoon on BBC Radio 3, it's time for Lucy Skeeping with this week's edition of The Early Music Show.
So atmospheric, isn't it? It's the sound of a lute, of course, that descendant of the Arabic oud, which went on to become the most popular instrument of the Renaissance, of kings and queens, Shakespeare plays, professionals and amateurs alike. And yet it's fair to say that in the late 15th century, it was vocal music that dominated the scene. Of course, ordinary people had their popular dance tunes for local festivals and merrymaking and so on. But in terms of art music, it was that wonderful, intricate, complex vocal polyphony that one could say really characterised the Renaissance and set the pace for further developments. Indeed, when it came to more formal compositions, purely instrumental music had something of a secondary position. It was relegated to the role of accompanying the voices, which makes the pioneering work of the musician who's the subject of today's show all the more remarkable. His name is Valentin Backfark, one of the most celebrated virtuoso lute players of the 16th century and an impressive composer too. In fact, we're hearing one of his fantasias right now. And like so many of the musicians we feature on the show each week, he travelled widely across Europe, showing his talent and serving at various noble courts. Hour, I'm going to be exploring Backfark's life and works. And to help me, I'm joined by the man we've just been listening to, one of today's most distinguished lutenists, American-born Jacob Herringman. His busy career, both as a soloist and as a member of numerous high-flying ensembles, has taken him to all corners of the globe. So I'm delighted we've managed to pin him down, if only for an hour. Welcome, Jacob, and many thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
So now, Backfark is an odd name, isn't it? I mean, who was he and where did he come from? Maybe you can just put him in context a bit.
Well, it's a slightly complicated story. He was born in present-day Romania, which was then Hungary, Transylvania, in fact. He was born into a German-speaking minority community living then in Transylvania. The city he was born in would have been known as Kronstadt in his time, Crown City. Nowadays, it's Brasov, which is the Romanian name. And he became one of the most celebrated musicians of his time. He was at numerous courts, the Polish court, the Hungarian court, the court of Maximilian II, the Holy Roman Emperor. And another patron was the Duke of Prussia. So he was a real European, hugely celebrated for his compositions and also for his virtuoso playing.
With such a sort of impressive CV, I'm quite surprised we've never, as far as I remember, featured him on the Early Music Show. I'm just wondering how you came across his music.
Well, when I first took up the lute and got particularly interested in Renaissance repertoire, his name came up quickly because he's sort of legendary among students of the lute, partly because of the notorious difficulty of his music, but also because he's thought of as one of the very greatest composers for the lute. There was an excellent complete works published in the 1970s by Daniel Benko and István Homolya, and I studied that collection and started playing the pieces, and then I came across the recordings by the same Daniel Benko of Bachfach's complete works. And those recordings are something of a reference point for lute players because no one else had really tackled his music.
He's an interesting player because it's a style that's not quite perhaps as lute players play today. Would you say that's fair?
Well, yes. These recordings were made in the 1970s. He sounds as though he's playing with nails. His musicality and his huge enthusiasm for the music comes through very well, and it's an impressive set of recordings. But nowadays we tend to play with the flesh of the fingertips on the Renaissance lute and to produce a much sort of warmer, plummier sound. So yes, the fashions have changed as we've come to know more about how lutes in the 16th century were made and played.
One thing about his playing, though, he's got this marvellous sort of crisp, clear style, so you can really hear the counterpoint, the different parts as they're played together, the different sort of overlapping tunes, if you like. You can really feel Bachfach's sound story. So here is Daniel Benko, then, a recording made back in the 70s, playing Fantasia No. 6 by Bachfach. Thank you. Fantasia No. 6 for solo lute by the Hungarian-Transylvanian composer-lutenist of the 16th century, Valentin Backfark. And it was played there by one of Backfark's countrymen, the lutenist Daniel Benko. Now, Jacob, Backfark was active, as you said, in the early to mid-1500s. And his lute pieces, well, the ones that have come down to us at any rate, seem to divide into three specific categories, I think, don't they? I mean, he wrote fantasias, and we've already heard one example, which were the sort of freestyle pieces. Can you tell us a little bit, actually, what a fantasia is? Because we're going to hear another one later on.
Yes, it's exactly that. It's a freely composed piece as opposed to an arrangement of something else. But having said that, in the middle of the 16th century, lute fantasias were generally composed in what's often called a motet style. That is, they imitate vocal polyphony. And in fact, instrumentalists were striving to emulate the human voice. So you could say that the line between fantasias and vocal music is a very fine line, because vocal styles enter the fantasia in this period. So although it's freely composed, it's not stylistically all that different from the vocal music of the time.
So kind of, I suppose you say, early songs without words, in a way.
Well, that's right, exactly that.
Now, another kind of piece Backfark wrote is what are called intabulations. And we're going to talk about those later on again. But right now, we're going to hear an example of the third category now, pieces that he based on dance forms. It starts with a rhythmic galliard, and then it moves into a rather stately, slow passamezzo. Presumably, Backfark was using existing popular dance tunes of the time as the basis for a piece like this, would he have been?
That's right. There were chord progressions known as grounds, which composers of the time would have tapped into in making their own dances. And I believe the galliard is based on an Italian song.
Great. Well, let's hear it. Here's the Benko consort this time. We're going to hear recorder, viols, and, of course, the lute. Thank you. the Benko Consort with a couple of dances by the composer Valentin Backfark. And we're going to hear some more dance-based pieces of his later in the programme. But let's have a little bit more about Backfark's life now. After showing great musical talent as a young boy, Backfark himself actually tells us that by the 1530s, he was a musical apprentice at the court of the Hungarian king Janos I. He then spent time in Paris in the early 1540s. But finding the position of lutenist to the king filled and unable to find any other work, he apparently left in 1549. Now, Jacob, before we talk about the next music that we're going to hear, can you tell us a bit more about lute playing at this period and how the instrument was actually viewed? As I said earlier, the emphasis was so much on vocal music at this time. So who would have played the lute?
Well, an interesting parallel is to think of the piano in the 19th century. It was the preferred instrument for domestic music making, for solo music, for accompanying the voice. Well, in a similar way, the lute was the preferred instrument in the 16th century, although it has to be said also that it was a courtly instrument. So every king or duke would have had a court lutenist, and they vied with one another for the best ones. Virtuosity on the lute was highly prized. That's why composers like Backfark were celebrated, and like John Dowland after him, and like Francesco da Milano before him. And in a way, that's a bit like virtuoso electric guitarists who are celebrated for their amazing prowess as virtuoso players.
Brian May, to quote just one example.
That's right.
Now, look, we left Backfark in Paris a moment ago. He found it hard to get work. But, of course, this was an opportunity for this young Hungarian to get familiar with style of French song at the time, which he must have heard around him. Songs such as that very popular song, Un Gay Bergère, which we're going to hear next. In fact, we're going to hear it twice in two separate versions. The first one is by the Franco-Flemish composer Thomas Crequillon, and it's followed by the version for lute that Backfark produced. I guess we would call it an arrangement these days, but in early music terms, these things were known as intabulations. Jacob, tell us a little bit about this intabulations. I mean, how common was it for composers to make their own arrangements, their own versions, if you like, of existing pieces? And why particularly on the lute?
Well, it was very, very common. In fact, if you look at the 16th century lute books, you find that the bulk of the material in them consists of intabulations, arrangements of vocal music for solo lute. Yes, there are fantasias, there are dances, but the intabulations take up more space than anything else. And there are a number of possible reasons for this. One is we have to consider that there must have been a market for them because, they ended up in printed books that were for sale. But also, it was a means of taking much-loved vocal music, sacred and secular, into a domestic setting. So they didn't have the hi-fi, they didn't have iTunes, they didn't have Spotify, and more's the pity, they didn't have Radio 3. But they did have...
You'll be invited again.
But they did have the lute, and it was a way of taking a piece of church music or a madrigal or a chanson into your own home and playing it for yourself or for a few friends. And it also has to be said that it's a fantastic compositional exercise. If you take a piece of, say, 4 or 5-part vocal music, take it apart from the inside and put it back together as a lute piece, you've gained a huge amount of understanding about how the music was put together in the first place. And that gave these composers the necessary skill to write fantasies in the vocal style. And as someone who has done a lot of intabulations myself over the years, it is a great way of coming to understand the vocal music in a very sort of intimate way.
So how do Backfark's compare with, say, intabulations by arguably composers that we're even more famous to us today?
Well, I think as an intabulator, he's unrivaled. His arrangements are very, very faithful to the vocal original, but not always following it slavishly. They're sort of faithful in spirit rather than to the letter of the original. He's bold and he departs occasionally in various ways from the original material, but somehow he's so in command of his material that he gives you a very strong and very surprisingly faithful rendition of the vocal original, even when it's heavily ornamented or even when the original is departed from in some way.
Mm. Well, let's hear the two pieces. The first version we're going to hear is, I suppose you could say, kind of fast and wordy, very typical of the French chanson style. And then the second, for solo lute, played by your good self, that's much more measured. French chanson, Un Gay Berger, the original first by Thomas Crequillon, performed there by the Jeannequin Ensemble, followed by the lute intabulation of the same piece by Valentin Backfock, played there by our guest today, Jacob Herringman. You're listening to The Early Music Show here on Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping, and today I'm exploring the life and work of one of the Renaissance's greatest lute players, Valentin Backfock, in the company of one of today's most distinguished lutenists, Jacob Herringman. So Jacob, Backfock almost certainly wrote an enormous amount of music, but very little of it was printed. I'm just beginning to wonder whether that might have been because it was incredibly difficult to play.
Well, that might be part of the story. All lute composers, without exception, were also players. And so he would have done a lot of playing of his own improvisations, his own arrangements, which didn't necessarily make it into the lute books. I get the sense from the quality of the material that does survive that perhaps he was a bit of a perfectionist and only printed his very best pieces. But it is true that his pieces are difficult to play. There's also a sort of austerity about his style, which perhaps makes him less immediately appealing. But it's such high-quality music that it very much deserves a hearing.
Well, next up, we're going to have another example of the way Backfark made intabulations. The piece in question this time is Faux d'Argent, a song in which the singers complain about their lack of money. It's by Josquin Desprez. Now, just tell us a little bit about Backfark's relationship to Josquin.
Well, as a lutenist with a particular love of polyphonic vocal music, he went for the very best composers of polyphony, and of course Josquin was the greatest of his generation. Backfark arranged that chanson. He also arranged a number of motets by Josquin, including the beautiful four-part Qui habitat in adiutorio, and also Stabat Mater by Josquin. So he must have particularly loved Josquin's music. And it's true that that it's wonderful music, which some of which lends itself very well to arrangement for the lute. It's interesting that Backfark puts his intabulation of that particular chanson about lack of money at the very end of one of his lute books. There's a bit of a tradition of putting significant pieces at the beginnings and ends of books. So very often you get an Ave Maria at the beginning of a book, for instance. Well, he places a song about not having any money at the very end of one of his lute books, which suggests that maybe he's trying to make a point very gently about being broke.
Yeah, and that sounds like a nice sort of chat with a bit of humour too. I like that.
Thank you.
French song Faute d'argent in the form of a lute intabulation by Valentin Backfark and played there by Jacob Herringman. Before that, we heard Josquin's song version of it performed by Yves Fagelini. Now, if the idea of intabulation seems a bit complicated, it's even more so if you consider that some of the pieces selected to be transcribed were of a religious nature, these complex vocal polyphony, which reached its peak in the Renaissance. Jacob, we've heard examples of Backfark's setting of popular songs, his intabulations of popular songs, but he must have been quite a glutton for punishment if he turned to such complex, sacred pieces to arrange for the lute as well.
Well, yes, that's true, and he wasn't the only one. The 16th century lute books have many, many examples of sacred polyphony, and they generally sit alongside the arrangements of secular music, so it's quite hard to get our heads around that. But in the lute books, there doesn't seem to be much of a distinction made between intabulations of madrigals and chansons on the one hand and church music on the other hand. All of it was music that these composers obviously considered worth getting their hands on and adapting for the lute. And it is a sort of quite normal instinct among instrumentalist composers to grab whatever you hear that you like and turn it into something that you yourself can play.
And I suppose a kind of a bit of a mixed bag in a collection was good for the market too.
Well, I think that's right. As these books were printed and sold, there must have been a market for it, yes.
Well, we're going to hear an example of a sacred piece now, followed, as before, by a version of it for solo lute. This is the Brabant Ensemble, directed by Stephen Rice, with the beautiful and contemplative Eravi Sicut Ovis, by another great composer of the Renaissance, Clemens Nonpapa. I have wandered like a sheep that is lost. See your servant, O Lord, for I have not forgotten your commandments.
Thank you.
church motet Eravis Sicut Ovis by Clemens Nonpapa, performed by the Brabant Ensemble, and it was followed by an intabulation of it for solo lute by Valentin Backfark, played there by Jacob Herringman, who's my guest today. So, Jacob, let's get back to what we know of Backfark's life and career. Now, from 1549, I think for about 13 years, he was employed as a court lutenist by Sigismund, King of Poland, wasn't he? And during that time, he, in fact, travelled quite widely.
That's right.
But his employment with the king came to a rather abrupt end, didn't it? And he had to flee. Can you elaborate on the story?
Well, there's a story that he was briefly arrested at that time, and no one seems to know precisely what happened. We know that he wasn't held for long, because he turns up somewhere else quite soon after that. I know some have speculated that he was consorting with the wrong people, with enemies of the king in some way. I don't know that anyone knows for sure exactly what happened, but he did seem to get into trouble there briefly.
He also served in the court of Emperor Maximilian in Vienna and then returned to Transylvania for a short time. But in the early 1570s, he moved to Italy, didn't he, where he stayed until his death, which was, what, in his mid-50s? What happened? It was the plague, wasn't it?
Sadly, he and his whole family died of the plague in, I think it was 1576. A great tragedy. He wasn't all that old, but unfortunately an all too common story.
According to one story, in fact, it was all his manuscripts disappeared because, in fact, they were burnt, which was apparently the custom for plague victims' possessions to be destroyed like that, which I wonder how true that is.
Well, I know that in some of the most recent scholarship has discovered that an inventory was done of his surviving music just after his death by, in fact, the neighbour of Backfark and his wife, who was a very famous lute maker by the name of Wendelin Tiefenbrucker. So certainly the stuff was still there just after Backfark's death. What happened to it after that? We don't know.
So how much of his music is left today? I mean, how much of it was published at the time or later?
Well, he himself supervised the publication of two books of lute music, one in 1553 in Lyon and one in Krakow in 1565. And this represents the bulk of what survives. It's the two great collections. And there's also assorted music in various manuscripts.
He was obviously a very famous and kind of celebrated man at the time. Why do you think that only a few lute players, such as yourself, are familiar with him today?
Well, it's true he was hugely celebrated in his own time, and there was a famous Polish proverb which says, "Don't take up the lute after Backfark," which presumably means don't bother because you'll never surpass him. maybe that's put us all off for life. But as I said earlier, although he was a great composer and his music is superb, there is a sort of austerity to it. It's not necessarily immediately as charming or appealing as, let's say, Francesco da Milano's before him or John Dowland's after him. But for a lutenist, it represents a sort of pinnacle, a technical challenge, but very much one worth pursuing because the quality of the music is so good. And from the point of view of a lover of music generally, it's simply good music that's well worth hearing.
Well, when I knew we were going to have this chat, I had a little scurry around to see if I could find a picture of Backfark. And I found a little engraving that was printed in a book of intabulations. I think it was dated 1553 in Lyon. And it shows him sitting at a table playing his lute with a manuscript book in front of him. He's got a beard and a sweet little cat with a feather in it. His music sort of open and out in front of him, flat on the table. You might have thought that a music stand would have made things easier, but maybe they hadn't been invented then. But he's obviously portrayed sort of as if he's mid-composing. What do you think? It's quite a cute little picture, that, actually.
It's a very interesting picture because he does seem to be at work composing. There is a book of music in front of him. There's a pen. There's an inkwell. There is what looks like a paper knife. And behind him, very large, are displayed two coats of arms, which I haven't researched the coats of arms, but that may refer to the fact that he was ennobled in Poland in, I think it was the 1550s. So maybe they're his own coats of arms, I'm not quite sure. Or maybe those of his patrons. The other interesting thing about that portrait is that he's playing an enormous instrument. It looks like a sort of bass lute. And I have to say, if he could manage to get his fingers around that music on a lute of that size, he must have been awfully good.
Yeah, or it might have been artistic license, I suppose.
Well, possibly, yeah.
It is lovely to be able to sort of put a face to a name, as it were. Well, look, earlier on we heard the virtuoso lutenist Daniel Benko, didn't we? And we're going to hear him again now in another one of Backfark's Fantasias, and it's followed by an anonymous Hungarian dance composed in memory of Backfark and performed by the Benko Consort. Benko consort with a gorgeous little Hungarian piece for flute and lute composed in memory of the great Renaissance lutenist Valentin Backfark, who we've been exploring today. The performers were the Benko consort, and before that their lutenist Daniel Benko played Backfark's Fantasia based on the popular tune by Clemens Nonpapa known as Rossignolé. Well, I'm afraid time's almost run out, but before we hear our final musical set today, as a lutenist yourself, Jacob, perhaps you can tell us your thoughts on Backfark's legacy.
Well, it's an unusually high-quality body of music, which was clearly celebrated in its own time, and it's one of those things, as I say, a sort of pinnacle for lute players, but it's music that I think very much deserves to be heard. It's among the best of the surviving lute repertoire. And yes, it's difficult, but then it's quite a lot of surviving lute music is relatively difficult, actually. And perhaps it's slightly undeserving that his music is always labeled as being terribly difficult. I also think, just from a player's point of view, that if something is good enough, it's worth taking the trouble, really.
Absolutely. Wise words. Many thanks for joining me, Jacob. We're going to end with one last intabulation of Backfark. Perhaps you'd like to introduce it, Jacob.
I believe this is the Fantasy number 7, which has a very interesting section at the end in which Backfark appears to be quoting the final section of a famous chanson by Josquin, which is a lament on the death of the composer Ockeghem. So you might say that in this piece, Backfark himself is lamenting the death of Josquin, who, of course, by this time was no longer around. So this seems like the perfect tribute to pay to the composer Backfark himself to end with this marvelous piece.
Thank you.
Back Fox, Fantasia No. 7, performed on the lute by Daniel Benko, ending that edition of the Early Music Show. The presenter, Lucy Skeeping, was talking to the lute player, Jacob Herringman. The programme was produced by Juan Carlos Jaramillo. If you'd like to listen again, just go to BBC Sounds and look for the Early Music Show. You'll find information about the music featured there too. In next week's programme, Lucy Skeeping's joined by the conductor Peter Whelan to explore the life and music of Matthew Dubourg, a great friend of Handel's and himself a celebrated violinist and composer. That's next Sunday, the usual time of 2 o'clock.
Meet the five young musicians who are resident on Radio 3 this week. Monday, Mark Simpson.
Expressing myself physically through my instrument is something that I kind of have to do.
Tuesday, Peter Moore.
I'm a horrendous perfectionist.
Wednesday, Issa Takane Mason.
Those pieces happen to be some of my absolute favourites.
Thursday, Soraya Maffey.
As a singer, we need other ears around us. We need people to hear us and tell us what's going on, because what we hear is very different.
Friday, Stephanie Childress.
It's the piece that got me into the violin and classical music.
Take Five, this Monday to Friday on BBC Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 3 o'clock. Time for Choral Evensong, which was recorded last Sunday in Portsmouth Cathedral to mark the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings. The canticles are sung to the service in G by Herbert Sumption, and the anthem is Viri Galilei, a setting by Patrick Gowers of texts for this season of Ascension Tide. The service begins now with an introit by Robert Ashfield, who served in the Royal Army Service Corps during the Second World War. Ah, see the fair chivalry come, the companions of Christ.